This is Fresh Air, and I'm Terry Gross. My guest is talk show host, comedian, and writer Dick Cavett. Dick Cavett's network and public television shows featured big-name stars, but also became a refuge for guest writers, actors, movie directors, publishers, politicians, sports figures, and philosophers who didn't want to bother with the banalities common to TV talk shows. Some of Cavett's guests might not have been invited onto other shows anyways because they'd be considered slightly too esoteric. But if you wanted to see a discussion about theater with Noel Coward, Alfred Lunt, and Lynn Fontaine, or a conversation about movies with film directors Brian De Palma, Martin Scorsese, and George Romero, then Cavett shows were the places to turn. Cavett got his start in television as a talent coordinator for the Jack Parr Show. Then he wrote jokes for opening monologues for most of the late-night talk show hosts, including Parr and Johnny Carson. Eventually, he hosted his own late-night show, which ran on ABC TV, opposite his former boss, Johnny Carson. From there, he moved on to public television, then cable TV. I asked Dick Cavett if he thought his image as late-night TV's intellectual worked for him or against him.
I can't think of any way it could work for anyone. The fact that it's an error and that I'm not an intellectual probably has more to do with either the quality of people who write about television or the fact that, or people who are on it, I'm not sure which, because I was foolish enough to think you had to read the guest's book to talk to them about it, which I, even some book reviewers we may both know, admit not doing. It's for a variety of reasons that I got this millstone of intellectual hung around my neck as if I were somebody that's good for you to watch. I'll admit to being reasonably intelligent, but intellectual. If they think I'm one, they've certainly never seen one, a real one. I don't know of any in television.
When you moved to public television, did you miss the commercials? Because in television, commercials can be a great time to like regroup and organize your thoughts.
Completely,
again.
Yeah. Buckley had warned me about that. He said, you want them to, you miss not having that moment to check off what you've forgotten or think, what was it I was going to say? And a funny thing I thought on the way here, and what have I covered so far? On the other hand, sometimes when it was a good half-hour show, it seemed to me like it had only been 8 minutes long. And at the beginning of the series, I remember guests would leave looking depressed, and I wasn't sure why. And one day one of them said backstage to his manager, why didn't he use me for the whole show? I said, he did. And he said, no, listen, I've been in this business. I know I was out there no more than 9 minutes. And they'd been on for the whole half hour. So that was not, other times, as you may well know, it looks like the someone has welded the hands of the clock at 17 minutes to go, and it is not moving.
One of the things I really admire about your interviewing style is that you come up with these questions that you certainly wouldn't prepare for, you know, just kind of spur-of-the-moment questions that wouldn't fit into an organized format or anything. And I've seen you ask questions like that and get incredibly interesting answers that if you planned a way to get someone to say that, you'd never come up with it and you'd never have found out about it.
I've never thought about that very much, but that's right. At some point, I began to realize that, you know, when you sit down to write questions, they begin to take on that deadly sort of formula interview that maybe the high school newspaper student will say, what is the exact population of Holland, Michigan? What are some of its principal industries? The way some of the stuff sounds that you put down when you write your... But I remember talking to Mr. Allen once about this, Woody, and I said, God, I've read 2 books on Nureyev now, and I got this New Yorker profile to read, and so on. He said, well, if you ran into him at a party, wouldn't you be able to keep up your end of the conversation? And I said, well, yeah, sure. And there's a good lesson in that. You often feel you have to be faithful to your preparation, too. And that leads to things like, and then they peeled away the last layer, pulled back the lid of the trunk, and you'll never guess what was inside, and you hear yourself saying, do you have any hobbies? So you can't over-prepare, you don't listen, and you don't react.
One of the kind of common rules of talk shows is that to get the big names, you exchange a plug. You know, whether it's mentioning the new movie and showing a clip or, you know, repeating the name of the book or whatever. Did you ever have any little mutinies against that? Do you accept that as the basic rule of the way the world operates in the world of talk shows?
Oh, God, yes. I'm long past being above plugging something. But if it's some real crappy thing, or if the plug is egregious, I wish I could remember who this was. Somebody came on and had been totally overcoached by the publisher to mention the name of the book, and the book had at least as many syllables as Rise and Fall of the Third Reich. And I think he got it in 4 minutes at least 13 times, we counted later. And I just sat and listened, and at the very end thanked him for being there and then said, oh, by the way, did we mention your book?
That's great.
And the applause that came crashing down and the laugh was almost cruel.
I think a great dilemma for anyone doing a broadcast interview is how to react if the interview is really boring. Because on the one hand, you're supposed to act really amused no matter what, but you don't want...
You feel your face muscles freezing with a smile and nodding too much and you didn't mean to, and then you think, oh, God, that person's mouth stopped moving. It's my turn to talk. What do they think?
And you don't want the audience to think that you're stupid enough to think that this is actually interesting, because you know it's
That's
not.
That's right. I never thought of that. That's the dilemma. You think, no, I'm nodding, but people are saying, does Cavett like this? Better do what Parr did often and say, look pal, I'm bored. Talk about something else. Let me talk. I can do it better.
When I spoke with Spalding Gray recently, he was telling me about the time that he was auditioned by The Tonight Show to be on. Mm-hmm. You know, the producer called up and had him talk to him on the telephone. The producer said, look, you have to understand that people who are watching The Tonight Show are trying to fall asleep. I mean, this sounds like the most depressing.
Did he wonder which producer
warning.
That was?
But as a late
night, I wonder
if
he's still a producer. Maybe he succeeded.
did you ever think about that when you were on late night TV? Because it's a very self-defeating way to think.
I didn't think about that, but what I was always aware of was things that you worried about in the studio were not worth worrying about, because the person at home with his feet up watching the show is not exercising any kind of strong. Every second counts, critical eye. And people, very smart people that I were connected with the business, would come and see a show in the green room and say they were stunned by the difference between the show they saw and the monitor in the green room, where you're there with the tension, the worries, the not knowing what's coming next, the pacing actor who's going on next and all of that. And then watching the very same show on still another television screen at home that night and thinking, my God, it's like it was re-edited. It's all different. It's easier to watch. It's more relaxed. So I learned that nobody's opinion who's in the studio, or if they think they've got one up on you, is saying, but I saw it on the monitor, so therefore I know what it looks like at home, is worth anything. I censored myself there.
You got your start in late-night television writing jokes for the monologues for Jack Parr.
That's right.
And then for Johnny Carson. Did you have to come up with really different styles of jokes for each of them?
Yeah, they're very different. Although, they're not as different as, say, there are more contrasting styles. You could give many of the same jokes to Carson that you would Parr and vice versa. But I could read what I wrote for the two of them and know which one I wrote it for, even though I've forgotten the jokes, because their wording is slightly different, their tone is different. There are things Jax would say that Johnny would never, and vice versa. Their quirks and things. And one thing I'm really good at, to make up for the many things I'm not, is that I can imitate people's voices at the typewriter. By voice, I mean in the writer sense of their entire, as the voice of Faulkner or whatever. But also, exactly how they'd word it is what's needed to be a gag writer for a specific comic. Otherwise, you need a rewrite man, because the guy sees the joke, but he says it doesn't fit me somehow, but he doesn't know how. Why?
Well, it's a regular part of Carson's monologue to insult the writer, say, oh, that one didn't work, I'll have to fire those writers.
Well, that's an old gambit of, I mean, the writers know that. Then some of them do get fired.
Did he take you aside? What kind of feedback would he give when you were writing for him?
Almost never. Jack would take more personal interest in the selection of the subject for the monologue, sweat it more, worry about it more. I mean, he sweated off enough energy worrying about his monologue as much as for all the rest of the show. Whereas Johnny's a little cooler about it. But one day, when I handed in a rotten 2 pages, the next day he said, I think you can do a little better. And that was the only time he ever admonished me, and I was so moved by it. I really wanted to do better for him because I like him so much. And I remember thinking, oh, my teacher has scolded me.
Did they have any personality or behavior quirks that you'd worry would show up that night and ruin the material that that you'd written?
That's a good question. Without any names, I'll tell you about one. Once a friend of mine and I were working for a famous star who was a notorious homophobe. We were writing this stuff and we disliked the man so much that we thought we would just hand in a suicide submission, you know, just everything that would get us fired. And we wrote this, we thought of this one joke that sort of, we decided to really hand in sort of seriously because it was a good joke. But he said, my friend David said, it needs a little something. And by this time we had decided to hand in serious stuff. And I said, well, why don't we just have it both ways? Just hand in the joke, but put in parentheses, after joke, put hand on hip and flounce around stage. And that gives you some idea of how you sometimes want to get at the personality of the person you're working for.
Did he fire you?
One time, when we were gone shortly thereafter, once I had the dubious distinction of writing humor for Art Linkletter, who was a host of the Tonight Show for 1 week, and he just, you know, he admitted he wasn't a comedian in the sense of monologue, so just, they just, well, no, he didn't admit it. It was quite forcibly brought home to him, I think, after the first couple of days. There's a classic example of what he did to a line in my book, Eye on Cavett. I think the joke I handed in was David Lloyd, who has an incredible memory, an Emmy-winning writer, Mary Tyler Moore and other shows, and Cheers and things, remembers this accurately. I think the joke I gave Linkletter was a mild little bit of humor that went something like, such famous comedy teams as Laurel and Hardy, Abbott and Costello, Jackie Leonard. For our younger viewers, Jackie Leonard was a very fat man, and therefore the joke. Most comics would have been able to get a laugh with such comedy teams as Laurel and Hardy, Kevin Costello, Jackie Leonard. Linklater didn't. And when he didn't get even the mild laugh that it deserves, he decided to help the joke by adding the words, here's how he did it. Such comedy teams as Laurel and Hardy, Abbott and Costello, and big fat Jackie Leonard, who is so big he is a one-man, I'm not finished, comedy team all by himself. A silence that you could drive a truck through. A vacuum. Linkletter is to comedy what Jack the Ripper was to etiquette.
When you started doing your own late-night talk show, you had already been close to like the greats of the art of the monologue. Did you want to do a monologue yourself?
Yes. I love doing monologue. When it works, it's wonderful. It does start a show well, if you're talking about 90 minutes. And I did stand-up comedy in nightclubs, and when that works, it's wonderful. And when it doesn't, you'd rather be under a fast-moving train. Yeah, but I almost think it isn't worth it. It's an enormous expense of time, money, and energy. And in fact, I saw why. I used to think Parr was crazy for worrying so much about it, because it's your first impression. If you go out there and do badly, unless you can go out with the absolute devil-may-care attitude of I don't care if I do badly, which then guarantees that you won't, in a way that's almost a Zen philosophy, I suppose, but not that easy to come by, then it is not worth all that trouble. And I've had good shows follow bad monologues, bad shows follow good monologues, and yet you always feel that you've killed the program if you walk out. I've hit on a principle here that I wish I could convey, but I learned it in early nightclub work. If you can convince yourself in stepping out in front of an audience that you don't give a damn whether they like you or not, and see the absurdity of the fact that you're submitting yourself to this ludicrous risk, and that you've stepped into the brightest lighted, raised part of a room in order to call attention to yourself and presume to amuse, and you're failing to do so, then it's funny. And if you can see it that way, you can survive anything. And I remember nights in the club where I would go out, I would start to bomb, and it just struck me as the funniest thing in the world. I was having the best time at their expense. I didn't care what they thought. I had a wonderful time. I asked a whole audience to get the hell out once at the Hungry Eye. And other times when it was just so painful, and you'd think, why can't I stand it tonight. This is awful, and they're getting to me, and I hate them for it, and myself. And I don't know any comic who doesn't have some of each. Maybe a few with total confidence. But I'm not sure I know any.
Where is it written that you absolutely have to do an opening monologue if you're doing a late night show?
Well, it isn't, and you don't, and that's a hell of a good question, because I remember many times I didn't, and the show went on just as well, and often it was, you know, people would say, well, why do you put yourself through that? I mean, which was a polite way of saying it's not worth it.
When you started your ABC show, your producer called you in after, I think, the first taping, and told you, nobody cares what Gore Vidal or Muhammad Ali has to say about the Vietnam War. The show's boring, we can't run it, Angela Lansbury was dull. And you had a big fight.
Yeah, that was not my producer, because he was on my side.
Oh, it was an executive.
It was an executive who just came and said, this is not the show we wanted, this is not the show we bought, this is deadly, horrible, nobody wants to hear about the Vietnam War and all that junk.
Well, I think what people really loved about your show was that it was different from what was on TV.
Well, that was also a classic case of went upstairs and looked at the tape. Just all of us depressed. We had failed. My network career had lasted one night and was going to be over before it began. I didn't care then. I was sick of them. I stomped out of their meeting and beat and exhausted, and my face drawn up and looked like a sculpture of Katharine Hepburn. And I had cheekbones showing that didn't usually. I was so tense. And then we all said, well, why don't we look at it? And so Fraser and I looked at it on a monitor. And as we watched, we thought, this isn't bad at all. Lansbury's bright. Charmy's getting laughs. It's fine. Ali was in. Vidal was fascinating. But a nervous Nelly at the network had decided that it was not what they wanted. So they had me tape another one. And that one had Pat Neal and Jack Albertson and, oh, I can almost come up with it. Oh, Buckminster Fuller and somebody else. And they ran that as the first show. Then the next one aired, and several critics then reviewed the show, saying the show got off to a lame first start, but the second one was brilliant. And that was the one that we had wanted first all along.
Was it typical at the network?
It was gratifying in its own way.
Yeah, I'm sure. Was it typical at the network to have fights about whether you should be exactly like everybody else or whether you should be able to do things a little bit different?
Yeah, and I think probably they were right and I was right too. In many cases, I'm sure I did things that were deadly dull as a result of my image. Or having people on who I thought might be interesting to such a narrow group of, because maybe I thought I ought to, of viewers and so on. But in general, I think it was probably the best talk show there's ever been on television. Certainly, I mean, in terms of its high points, and I don't care whether that's immodest or not, because when I look back at the Lunt Fontan Coward show or the alcoholism shows, or the Mailer Vidal Janet Flanner show, or something. Just looking at them, believe me, I can. I'm that disengaged from my own personality on television. I can see them as a viewer. I wish something like that were on. I'd love to see it. No wonder people liked them. I didn't realize how good they were.
Are you the only talk show host in television who never interviewed Zsa Zsa Gabor?
Who hasn't interviewed her? I would think. Now, I don't dislike her. It's just that once I think somebody said Cavett has never had the Gabors on, he should get a medal for this. And I cravenly continued not to have them on to curry his favor. Fact is, almost everybody, I can't think of anybody I really would not, well, no, that's not true. I mean, but there's nothing wrong with having them on except for their overexposure, and I maybe should have, because of one thing that I always find interesting about me. People are different with me, and I would have been interested to see how she was. Sometimes it's good and sometimes it's bad. I can't stand it when somebody comes on with me and thinks they have to be intellectual because of this misperception that I am, and so a hilarious man like Buddy Hackett might feel he has to come on and talk about Tolstoy. I love it, for example, when Bob Hope came on with me, who's always been one of my gods, of course. as a young comedian and so on, and actually talks. He's one of the most interesting, best, compelling raconteurs of his past and the great life he's led. And when it always seems to me on other shows, he'll go on and he'll talk and he has a lot of jokes and I laugh because he's Bob Hope. But I want to know, you know, what it was like when he was hungry and what would he do if he weren't in the business, which he mentioned on a show of mine and startled everybody. He would, and other things about him that you don't often get at. So maybe Zsa Zsa, maybe I could have ripped the mask of hypocrisy from her face.
When you moved to PBS from commercial network television, did you enjoy that, or was just they're just a different kind of aggravation that you had to face on public TV?
Well, public television is not Valhalla or whatever the word is I want in terms of being free of network pressures. That was a little disillusioning that they eagerly consult ratings and worry about a buck, which, of course, they have to. And so a little more than I found tasteful considering their frequent public posturing about how this is where you don't have to worry about that sort of thing. But it doesn't surprise me, nor should it, except that it would be a mistake to think that they don't at all. There are so many advantages to being on public television because they do, even though, it's not much of a compliment today to say they supply the best television there is, because television has really gotten so unbelievably bad that the snobs who used to say, I don't watch much television, or and did but didn't want to let you know. Now, many, many, many people just don't.
You're an interviewer who's also been interviewed a lot television, radio, and print, magazines, newspapers. Have you learned a lot about interviewing through being interviewed?
Gee, so far you haven't asked one cliche question. Can't you give me some easy stuff? I think from the best people, you kind of instinctively do. And also from the worst people, you instinctively learn what not to do yourself. But I'm not the sort of person to consciously analyze that sort of thing. And when people say to me, what is it you do that makes guests come off and say, my God, I didn't mean to say that, or I mean, he got things out of me I didn't know anybody could, or I never felt more comfortable on the days when they say that. I don't have any idea what it is I do, except that maybe in some way I identify with the guest, having been one, or know what it feels like.
You're still a friend of Woody Allen's, right? When you met, were you to him...
I don't see him that much anymore. It's too bad, anyway, and it's a success. It's one of the... What? One of the problems of his success, I guess.
I keep thinking he must have kind of studied you closely to see what a Midwestern goy was like. I know he never gets out of New York, you know?
Every so often I fancied I saw myself in something he did. But an artist just picks from those things he knows, doesn't he? Yes, I think once or twice he's given a couple of my qualities to somebody or phrases. There was one I remember distinctly. In some movie, I picked up a phrase from a seminar leader at Yale. The phrase was, I can't quite get my mind around this. And I liked that phrase. And I remember I used it a couple times in Woody's presence. And Keaton says it in one of his films. And I think it was new to him then. And that may have been my contribution to Woody's collected works. That and my brief appearance in Annie Hall. Do you remember me in any way?
No, I don't.
Be honest now. Do you think I was the best thing in it? There's a moment in it, I can forgive you, because it's so thoroughly integrated. There's a moment in it when, you remember the character was a comic, and he appears on my show. And there's a moment when the screen fills with a gray, grainy television picture. And I say to Woody, you seem to have avoided the war. What was your draft status? Or whatever. He does this joke about I was 8F, or in the event of war, I'm a hostage. It was shot for the movie so realistically that people thought it was taken from my show. And in fact, later in our Woody were saying, he probably did do that joke on a show of mine. But we shot it for Annie Hall, one day's work. I think I got $200.
I don't remember that part, and it reminds me of something you've always said on your show.
I don't see anybody could.
Well, you always say on your show that one of your big fears is that someday you're going to be administered this like general knowledge exam. Like,
oh, my nightmare is to take a general knowledge test in public and have them say, how many senators are there from each state? Yeah, blah, blah, blah.
Well, I mean, one of my fears is that someone's going to say something, and I'll say, sure, I remember that, and it never happened, and it's just a little quiz to see
if I'm
lying or not. Really?
Oh, God, yes. I had somebody on once, and they said, you know, I've been spreading myself out a little, doing different kinds of work, stretching myself, and I think the psychopath that I was fortunate enough to play on such and such show is, and I said, oh, that was wonderful, and they said, well, it hasn't been on yet. And then you do that thing of, oh, that psychopath on that. Oh, yeah, but I was thinking the one. Didn't you do another? And you feel its forehead scalding.
I have one question in our remaining couple of seconds, which is, I dare you to come up with any good anagrams for my name, Terry Gross. I think this one will really stump
you. How do you spell your first name?
With a Y, T-E-R-R-Y.
Yeah. Well, now see, that isn't a good anagram name because there are only two vowels and all those consonants. And also, I can't do them on command.
Oh, I see.
That's
bizarre.
It's almost unconscious.
But you do them all the time during interviews.
Yeah, but that's I don't mean to.
Oh.
When I had Theobald on, and I was tired, and he was interesting, the futurist Theobald, and I suddenly realized I had tuned out. He stopped talking, and I said, you realize your name's an anagram for bad hotel. And the audience roared. Alec Guinness's name on a marquee was my masterpiece. I was driving past it and thought, genuine laces, no, genuine class. And it is. And it comes like that. I don't deserve any credit for it. And I don't know what it has to do with. Some reason, I knew Carson was going to mention it. And I was on my way to the studio three or four appearances ago on The Tonight Show with him. And I looked out and looked for a newspaper to see if there was a headline or something I could make an anagram out of. Driver said, you don't hear much about Agnew anymore. I thought, Agnew, Wenga, Gnu, Wange, Spiro Agnew, a pine grows. Now, if you're an anagrammatist, you know that this, you know when you haven't reached the ultimate anagram. And I thought, Spiro Agnew, there's something better in there. And just as I stepped out of the limo, I thought, grow a penis. And that is the anagram for Spiro Agnew.
Oh, what's your name spelled, by the way?
Richard A. Cavett. Let me see if I can come up with something. Catch it, a rare VD. Actually, that is one, but someone sent it to me.
That was talk show host and writer Dick Cavett, my guest on this edition of Fresh Air.